Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, a different type of program, the latest on health and healing, always, but then the remainder of the program will be with Gerald Salante, one of the best trends predictors in the world. For the last 30 years, Gerald Salante has predicted all the major bubbles before anyone else, and all the directions that we were going, constructive or destructive, and he's going to be here today. But what I'm going to be doing with Gerald is I'm going to select a number of very important commentaries and issues that do not get any objective presence in the mainstream or alternative media. There's this assumption that if you're not hearing something on the networks, CNN, ABC, NBC, or on the cable channels, then you'll certainly hear it in the alternative media. Yes and no. You'll certainly hear things you won't hear in the mainstream media, but it doesn't mean that it's always done objectively. For example, the main promoters of vaccines and the supporters of mandatory vaccines like Gardasil are on the left. And even when you present information and documentation that this should be challenged, they won't do it. So we try to keep away from ideologies and focus upon ideas. And that's what you're going to hear today. Lots and lots of ideas. I don't think we'll get to all of them, but I have over 30 areas that I'm going to ask Gerald Salante about and give you some overview on. But let's begin. Today, there was a report out from Nobel laureate James Watson. You remember that Dr. Watson won his Nobel Prize for his discovery of the double helix. And now he's come up with, quote, a novel hypothesis regarding the role of antioxidants and oxidants in cancers that are currently incurable, notably late-stage metastatic cancers. And here's what is said in this. It says that that he's looking at the ROS. And by the way, ROS means reactive oxygen species, noting their fundamental two-sidedness, what he calls a positive force for life because of their role in apoptosis and an internal program that highly stressed cells use to commit suicide. It's one of the key mechanisms that have arisen through eons of evolution to weed out biological dysfunction that poses a threat to the survival of the organism. On the other hand, ROS are also well understood and indeed are notorious, quote, for their ability to irreversibly damage key proteins and nucleic acid molecules, the DNA and RNA. So what he's looking at here is things such as blueberries and antioxidants and foods rich in antioxidants. And if Watson is correct about the role of these antioxidants in late-stage cancer, as he writes in his new paper, quote, blueberries best be eaten because they taste good, not because their consumption may lead to less cancer. Well, understanding why this is so, why antioxidants can in late-stage cancer actually promote cancer progression, he is so off base on this. So here is my statement. Dr. Watson, we have been told that once you understand the genetic composition of life and you're able to map all these genes, that immediately medicines and new applications of medicines to these genes would reverse genetic predisposition. It has not. That we would be able to reverse the disease of organs, the brain, and help people with Alzheimer's and multiple sclerosis and ALS. It hasn't happened. In point of fact, if you ever actually came into a clinician's office, a holistic physician, nurse, chiropractor, naturopath, nutritionist, dietitian, you would find that there are tens of thousands of us who find that when we are working with people who are terminally ill, it is the antioxidants from food and supplements, including high-dose vitamin C, that has actually reversed end-stage cancer and has helped promote healing. In virtually all the studies, if you took the time to examine them, all the studies show that those who eat a rich diet in fruits and vegetables live a longer life, upwards of 9.8 years in the longest study done since the 1960s on Seventh-day Adventists, and that was published by Loma Linda University. But there are also other studies, thousands of studies, showing the power of antioxidants. What is apparent here is that you've just become aware of late-stage cancer, and you become aware of antioxidants. You also are fully aware, I'm sure, that when you're out running, which is good for you, you're increasing oxidative stress. You're increasing free radicals. You're also aware that it's good to lower your pulse rate. It's good to increase circulation to the brain and extremities. And it's good for detoxification. It's also important, if you take antioxidants and those blueberries that you just want us to eat because they taste good. Well, sir, there's over 500 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing what blueberries actually do for us. And they trap the free radicals, and they reduce oxidative stress. If you're a smoker or a drinker or an unhealthy dieter, it helps stave off disease. Just amazing what happens when people who have a reputation and assume that because they look at something, the world should stop, hold its breath until they give a pronouncement, and he is absolutely on the wrong track there. But don't do the right thing. Talk with the people actually reversing disease, not looking into some obscure and esoteric text. Some good reasons to eat basil. Basil's, of course, delicious. I grow basil. I grow a lemon basil, a cinnamon basil, a lime basil. There are hundreds of varieties of basil, and it's always really nice when you can eat it fresh and organic. But there's reasons that we should have basil on a regular basis, and especially the oils that come from the basil. Now, either dried basil or fresh basil are both good, but the fresh basil is actually better. It has natural anti-inflammatory agents, and that can help combat bowel inflammation, such as diverticulitis, colitis, spastic colon, Crohn's disease. It's very important for rheumatoid arthritis. It helps digestion. It's used very successfully for intestinal parasites, and taking some basil oil if you have intestinal parasites would be outstanding for you. It has antimicrobial properties, the fresh basil leaves and basil oil, very good in that, and it disinfects surfaces. In fact, if you put basil leaves on wounds, it helps eliminate infections. Basil is very high in antioxidants, which trap free radicals. It's been used with some skin ailments, such as ringworm. Basil juice is used directly applied. Most forms of cancer would benefit. Respiratory disorders, bronchitis, asthma, relieves cold and flu symptoms and allergies. It also can help with reducing cholesterol, with kidney stones, with mouth sores, insect bites, and even stress. So all of those are reasons why we should incorporate basil into our diet. And the latest study shows that 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day keep a heart attack away. This is from the Times of India from Mumbai, and I'll quote this. It says, "Women may be just able to keep heart attacks away by eating 7 servings of fruits and vegetables every day." By the way, this was published in the American Journal of Medicine. The study looked at diets rich in antioxidants and then the risk of heart attacks in women. And what they found is that antioxidants can stop cell damage that can lead to disease resulting from natural body processes, the very thing Dr. Watson was talking about, but coming down on the wrong side of history and science. Easily available antioxidants are vitamin A and vitamin C that are found in fruits and vegetables. And while the theory that antioxidants could check the spread of heart disease has been around for some time, this study quantifies just how much of these naturally occurring chemicals are needed to keep your heart healthy. 32,000 Swedish women, ages 49 to 83, over a long period of time, 10 years, were categorized into five groups based upon their diet. And what they found was that the women who had the highest antioxidants from their diet had 20% lower risk of a heart attack, and that was 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And that is good news. Painkillers are more deadly than heroin and cocaine. This is the latest. Prescription painkillers kill more people in the United States than heroin and cocaine combined. Experts from the Prescribing Drug Monitoring Program, the Center for Excellence at Brandeis University, Heller School of Social Policy Management, systematically assessed prescription drug monitoring programs and found a patchwork of strategies and standards. Quote, an epidemic of prescription drug abuse is devastating American families and draining state and federal time, money, and manpower. And it goes on to talk about all this death, and yet not a single effort is being made in the United States to inform people the dangers of pain-killing medications, from aspirin to the other major brands. And that's unfortunate. A couple more things that are important here before we take our first break and get Gerald Salante on. Low-calorie cranberry juice, meaning sugar-free cranberry juice, can cut blood pressure. This is a good study, and it was at the American Heart Association's High Blood Pressure Research Scientific Session, and it said, quote, drinking low-calorie cranberry juice regularly may help get your blood pressure under control. In a study that measured the effects of drinking low-calorie cranberry juice, participants drank either low-calorie juice or a placebo drink every day for 8 weeks as a part of a controlled diet. Blood pressure was measured at the beginning, midpoint, and end of the study. After 8 weeks, blood pressure values had significantly dropped from an average of 121 over 73 to 118 over 70 for those drinking the low-calorie cranberry juice. The placebo group, no change. So why don't we simply do the right thing, and why don't we advocate people use unsweetened organic cranberry concentrate, which will give them even a greater effort at lowering blood pressure and helping prevent bladder infections. And finally, let me give something that shows the Dr. Watson, who says, quote, eat your blueberries because they taste good, but they're not going to do anything for late-stage cancer. Sir, you are wrong. You were wrong before. Your whole group of geneticists have been wrong with deadly consequences. I can just imagine all the women today who have no breast, who had no cancer of the breast, but had the so-called gene that would predict cancer at some time in the future. So they went ahead at the advice of their oncologists and surgeons and had completely healthy breasts removed. Mothers even had their daughters and teenagers' healthy breasts removed so they wouldn't get cancer of the breast and die sometime in the future. Never thought of that as the unintended consequences of predicting everything was in the genes. This is from the Journal of Nutrition, a major peer-reviewed journal. This was done at the Division of Tumor Cell Biology at the Beckman Research Institute of the City of Hope in California. Quote, the size of breast tumors in lab mice was between 60 and 75% smaller when the animals were fed blueberries along with their diets. Quote, importantly, the dosage used in these studies was non-toxic and may be considered physiological because the human equivalent dose of about 5% of this was about 10.6 ounces of fresh blueberries, or about 2 cups per day. Future clinical trials using whole blueberry powder are planned that will aid in the determination of a suitable human dose. So let's just see here. Consumers using blueberries then could not only help with cancer, but also help prevent cancer. Lots of flavonoids in the blueberries, and anthocyanins in the blueberries, and flavanols in the blueberries. The very important things that we need on a regular basis. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment for what hopefully will be the next 45 minutes of very interesting insights into the next 12 months.
Change, change, change.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. For the rest of the program, commentaries on issues that I find important. And my guest, Gerald Salante, will be listening in, and we'll go to him in about 15 minutes. First up, I want to share something from Tony Newman from Alternet. I'm sure many people in this audience realize that we have a completely failed war on everything. The war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terrorism, the war on cancer, the war on homelessness. We have not had any victories because we're wrong-headed in our approach. I believe I speak for many people when I say that the war on drugs, which is America's longest war, it's over 40 years now since President Nixon launched the war on drugs, they're as plentiful as ever. And yet, look at the consequences that we're not examining. We're not examining these on any level, including on violence. First, there is racial injustice. The war on drugs is built on racial injustice. Despite roughly equal rates of drug use sales, African-American men are arrested 1,300% the rate of white men on drug charges in the United States, with rates up to 5,700%. You heard me right, 5,700% higher for African Americans in some states. African Americans and Latinos together make up 29% of the total U.S. population, but they're 75% of drug law violators in states and federal prisons. Also, the denial of access to education, housing, and benefits. Passed by Congress in 1998, the Higher Education Act delays or denies federal financial aid to anyone ever convicted of a felony or misdemeanor drug offense, including just marijuana possession. A drug offense will also get you and your entire family kicked out of public housing. 32 states ban anyone convicted of any drug, a felony, from collecting food stamps. Then we have wasted tax dollars. U.S. federal, state, and local governments now spend $50 billion per year trying to make America drug-free. State prison budgets top spending on public colleges and universities. The prison industrial complex is ever more powerful. Nevertheless, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and illicit drugs are cheaper, purer, and easier to get than ever before. And then what about unsafe neighborhoods? Most drug-related violence stems not from drug use, but from drug prohibition. That was true in Chicago under alcohol kingpin Al Capone, and it's true now. The mass killings in Mexico, over 60,000, in many U.S. cities are not from marijuana or other drug use, but because the plants are worth more than gold, and people are willing to kill each other over the profits to be made. How about the shredding of our constitutional rights? Armed with paramilitary gear, police break into homes unannounced, terrorizing innocent and guilty alike. Prosecutors seize private property without due process. Citizens convicted of felony offenses lose their rights to vote, and in some states for life. And more Americans are subject to urine tests without cause. But also, what about just stopping people on the streets? Over 600,000 people stopped in 1 year, mainly African Americans and Latinos, stopped, and they're searched. And then they're arrested as often as not. What do you think that does when just being of color and walking on a street, you're now considered suspect? And what does it say about the Latino and African American police officers who obey such a fascistic law without thinking? When we look at other capitals around the world and you have peaceful demonstrators challenging the corruption of their government, who are the people who come and beat them, shoot them with rubber bullets, and tear gas them, and taser them? It is their police. And we think, gee whiz, man, those are terrorizing police officers. Yeah, and we have the same thing here. Because any African-American police officer that accepts that they have a moral obligation or a legal obligation to stop another black person who has committed no crime because they're black and therefore they're more likely to commit a crime is an egregious insult to everything that is factual. That is racism. That is race on racism. And yet it is not only tolerated, it is common. Look at the bloodbath in Latin America. U.S. drug policies in Latin America failed to reduce the supply of illicit drugs. Instead, our policies have led to a bloodbath of more than 60,000 people killed in prohibition violence since 2006 alone in Mexico. And our policy and strategies have empowered organized criminals, corrupted governments, stimulated violence, assaulted the environment, and created tens of thousands of refugees. And yet we take no responsibility for any of that. We have compromised teenagers' safety. The defenders of the failed war on drugs say that we can't discuss alternatives to prohibition because it would, what is it, Bill O'Reilly and the other neocons say, the self-righteous warmonger say, quote, we'll send the wrong message to the kids. Do you? Do you want to know what message you send to the kids? I'll get to that in a moment. Ironically, the drug war is a complete failure when it comes to keeping young people from using drugs. Despite decades of DARE programs with the simplistic just say no message, 50% of teenagers will try marijuana before they graduate and 75% will drink alcohol. Young people also feel the brunt of marijuana enforcement and make up the majority of arrests. Arresting young people who often cause more damage than the drugs use itself. Teenagers need honest drug education to help them make responsible decisions. Safety should be the number one priority, not punishment. And also, what about drug treatment? I have helped thousands of people through Trafalgar Hospital's drug interdiction program when I was on the board of trustee at Trafalgar Hospital, but I was also a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology across the street, which was associated with the hospital. And I know what really helps people get off drugs, and I work mainly with young people and teenagers. But it's nothing that we're doing, nothing. Despite the government's lip service to the need for treatment, most of the drug work budget goes to criminal justice military agencies. The majority of those who need treatment can't get it. And for many, the only way to get treatment is to get arrested. We should never put people in a cage because they have a drug problem, and we should make treatment available to all who want it without criminalizing them and putting them on a database. And what about public health. Unsterile syringe sharing is associated with hepatitis and AIDS. And yet state paraphernalia and prescription laws limit access to sterile syringes in pharmacies. And U.S. government stands alone among Western industrialized nations in refusing to fund needle exchange. And then we destroy families. The number of people behind bars on drug charges in the United States has ballooned from 50,000 in 1980 to a half a million today, more than all of Western Europe, with a bigger population, incarcerates for everything. Millions of people in the United States now have a father, mother, brother, sister, daughter, son behind bars on drug charges. So what do we do about it? We have both the House and the Senate and the White House say something should be done, maybe more money for the war on drugs, maybe more arrest, maybe more search and seize. That's not the answer. Everything we're doing wrong on the war on drugs. My guest is now on the line. Let's go over and say hello to Gerald Celante. Nice to have you with us, Gerald. Gerald, what I want to do today is I want to go through a series of commentaries, short ones, on topics that are not getting the attention. I'd like you to give us your short feedback on each one.
Okay.
All right. I just gave you our first one, our failed war on drugs.
Well, it's obvious, and it's part of the whole military security complex. And it's as you kept pointing out, all the breaches of our human rights and dignity by the police and others. It's just another part of the whole construct of what's happened to America. Whether it's warrantless wiretapping, wars on drugs, it's a militaristic society, and they all end in failures. It's not only the war on drugs, it's the wars overseas, it's the wars on everything. So, and again, and when you're talking about these issues, for example, with every state now, Governor Cuomo making a statement today about gun control, there's virtually no talk at all about the psychotropic drugs that these people have been on. If you want to talk about a war on drugs, and so many of these mass murderers are whacked out on, and when you look at the trend line for these violent crimes, these mass murders being committed, they follow a perfect trend line of when all these psychotropic drugs have been being used and pushed into the brains of these people that are unstable to begin with. So the war on drugs is just another failure among all the other wars being fought.
All right, let's go on to another. We're going to try to keep our answers short because we have so many things to handle here. This is from Richard Clark from Op-Ed News, and he says, is our economy being artificially maintained and propped up? If so, how and why? I'm not going to go through it. I'm just going to give you the titles. Superfluous goods sector jobs. It's not just that the official unemployment numbers are a fraud. Most of the actual numbers are in some important sense fake as well. Ask yourself how many workers today actually produce something of core value, and then understand that 80% of all the jobs in the United States could disappear tomorrow, and if it were the right 80% of them, it wouldn't affect basic human survival or happiness in the least, provided everyone had enough money to buy the products and services that were still being produced, products like food staples and basic housing, services like basic health care, education, and public transport and utilities. Yes, in our society, we need money to survive, and jobs provide that money, but that doesn't mean that any and every job necessarily provides any core benefit. And then when I took a look at the actual statistics, I found out that most of the new jobs came because of the holiday season and because these were short-term workers brought in at low wages to work in retail outlets. And now that these holiday season's over, they're going to go away. And the actual unemployment rate in the United States, if we're honest, is about 23%. And yet we're not being told the truth. Why can't we be told the truth about the fact that we have a 23% unemployment rate instead of this artificial nonsense of 7.8?
Because they lie about everything. They never tell the truth. How about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda? When did they ever tell the truth? And John, that's John Williams' Shadow Stats, which I urge everybody to look at. He really has the best numbers out there. And again, it's very important to look at this globally. And the only reason the economies are being propped up, and you even could pick up today's Wall Street Journal, you name the country, even Switzerland, that used to be, you know, the benchmark for smart economic fundamentals in running an economy, are printing money. The new head of the Bank of Japan, the Prime Minister of Japan, Abe, he's employed the Bank of Japan to print money. Every country out there is printing endless streams of money at virtually no interest rates going to the banks. That's the only thing that's propping this up. And yes, the jobs are not the kind of jobs that are producing either goods or futures for the people that have them.
Did you see the interview between Alex Jones and Piers Morgan on CNN Monday night?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I believe that Alex would have been a lot more effective had he not hit that third rail of going from outrage to rage. But if you listen to what he actually said for many of his points, it's worth noting. I sent Piers Morgan today documentation, specific and scholarly documentation that would withstand any court cross-examination of the person's name, their medications they were on, psychiatric medications, how many people they injured or killed, when they did this, where they did this. So we have hundreds and hundreds of these cases. And yet, when we talk about violence in the United States, we only think about gun violence. And then suddenly it becomes, we have to get a greater handle on gun violence. Why can't we also discuss other aspects of this? Not that we shouldn't have open and honest discussions about guns, we should. But this is something from Sleuth Journal. U.S. takes the lead in killing of children. Quote, over the last 10 years, four times more children died in the United States from domestic violence than soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan during the war. This is the worst death rate in the developed nation. This means the myth that adopted children would be better off in the United States than in Russia is doubtful. In addition, no one knows what awaits these children in the United States. In December, the U.S. organization Child Help, that helps children affected by violence, released a new report. The authors of the report wrote about, quote, hidden epidemic of child abuse in the United States. Annually, 3.3 million reports of violence, over about 6 million children, are received. Every day in the United States, more than 5 children die for reasons related to violence. The authors of this study conclude the U.S. set the worst record in all developed countries in the world. The most widespread child abuse is neglect of their lives and interest, 78.3%, followed by physical violence, 17.6%, sexual violence, 9.2%, and psychological violence, 8.1%. Over 80% of the children who died of violence were under 4 years of age. In approximately 6% of the cases, death certificates did not specify that the cause of death was abuse. And then it went on to talk about more. So on the one hand, we do not acknowledge or recognize that we are a violent nation. So here we have some statistics that no one has talked about. 3.3 million reports of violence on 6 million children. That's an epidemic. Those are serious numbers. Separately, 75% of all gun violence is with gangs. Now, it was 4 years ago when you were on the program that you and I predicted that there would be a boom in the gangs because of the economy and young people being unemployed or disenfranchised and wanting to protect what they have or help their parents. They would join gangs because of gangs offered them a sense of community. Gangs gave them food and protection. Gangs stopped them from being bullied. But also then the gangs extracted loyalty. And then they became a part of their criminal operations. And violence is generally one of the mainstays against others of how gangs spread. Now the FBI report shows 1.4 million gang members, a 40% increase in just the last 3 years. And I'm predicting that it's going to double we're going to have 3 million gang members, which means there won't be a single safe place in the United States free of gang influence. And gangs, the poorer it gets, the more stressed the economy, the more unemployment, they're going to increase. And yet not a word about gang violence. And the gangs have no problem getting any weapon they want. And what are they going to do about gang violence? So thus far, two, three things are off the table. No discussion about the fact that every single killer of in these mass homicides has been on psychiatric meds. Gang violence.
No, you're right.
Gang violence is 75%. And no effort to deal with gangs or the underlying reasons people join gangs, poverty and opportunity. No discussion of actual childhood violence. You see, if you narrow, like the people in Congress who are really idiots, but if they narrow the discussion to the talking points have to be register guns, not register guns, have only handguns or get rid of the semi-automatics, that misses the whole larger argument. Are we a violent nation? If you take away just people who are killed and you look at people abused by violence, then you see that more people were killed by hammers and knives and bats. So are you going to ban knives, hammers, and bats? And what about the kids under four who were abused by fists? Are you going to register and ban fists? The insanity of how they're going about this, they're not even knowing which questions to ask. So I've given you three areas where we're extraordinarily violent, where we're not dealing with psychotropic drugs as a cause of violence, because a person literally loses their sense of mental capacity, gang violence, which is epidemic, and physical abuse, mental abuse, and neglectful abuse, leading to abuse that is killing children in the United States. Your thoughts?
We have a culture of cruelty. And, you know, to me, the fish rots from the head down. And why shouldn't other people be violent if the presidents and the politicians extol violence and even brag about it? And you heard Hillary Clinton after Gaddafi was dead, that famous clip out there. We came or something. He died, and she starts laughing, and so does the host. And then, you know, now President Obama has just announced his new selection for the CIA head, and he's one of the prime architects of Drones Away, killing suspected terrorists believed to be militants and any collateral damage around them. No one cares. How many people were killed in Iraq? You know, how much depleted uranium was dropped? How about the ongoing war going on in Afghanistan? And I mentioned Libya, and now we're going into Syria. It's a culture of violence. Turn on the TV. It's a culture of violence. Watch Hollywood. It's a culture of violence. Watch the video games. It's a culture of violence. It's a culture of cruelty. And that's really, to me, what it is, more than violence. It's cruelty. How about, I have a good name for you. How about enhanced interrogation techniques? Let's not call it torture. Look what they're doing to this poor guy, Bradley Manning, this kid. Yeah, it's a culture of cruelty.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, we got the point. You nailed it. All right. But we're not willing to look at the real underlying causes of violence. Instead, we have politicized the issue to a point where we leave off the table for discussion and change that which could really make a difference. Economic opportunity, educational opportunity for those who are now deprived of that, and that's going to lead to an unhappy outcome for most of them. Next up, from Naomi Wolf from The Guardian. Revealed how the FBI coordinated the crackdown on Occupy. I'll just read the first paragraph. It was more sophisticated than we had imagined. New documents show that the violent crackdown on Occupy last fall, so mystifying at the time, was not just coordinated at the level of the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security and local police. The crackdown, which involved, as you may recall, violent arrests, group disruption, canister missiles to the skulls of protesters, people held in handcuffs so tight that they were injured, people held in bondage till they were forced to wet or soil themselves, was coordinated with the big banks themselves. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, in a groundbreaking scoop that should once more shame U.S. major media outlets, filed this request. The document, reproduced on their site, shows a terrifying network coordinated Department of Homeland Security, FBI, police, regional fusion centers, and private sector activities so completely merged into one another that the monstrous whole is in fact one entity, in some cases bearing a single name, the Domestic Security Alliance Council, and it reveals this merged entity to have one centrally planned, locally executed mission. The documents, in short, show the cops and Department of Homeland Security working with big banks to target, arrest, and politically disable peaceful American citizens. The documents released after a long delay in the week between Christmas and New Year show a nationwide metaplot unfolding in city after city in an Orwellian world. Six American universities are sites where campus police funneled information about students involved in the Occupy Wall Street effort to the FBI. With the administration's knowledge, banks sat down with the FBI officials to pull information about Occupy Wall Street protesters harvested by private security groups. Plans to crush Occupy events, plans for a month down the road, were made by the FBI and offered to the representatives of the same organizations that the protesters would target. And even threats of assassination of Occupy Wall Street leaders by sniper fire, by whom, where, now remain redacted. So they actually, the FBI, Homeland Security, and the big banks had targeted people for assassination. And this is all right there. Where is the outrage anywhere in the United States? On every single college campus, everywhere there was an Occupy movement, they were being cataloged as terrorists. Now they're on terrorist list. Every single person. They were all photographed, retinal scans. They were infiltrated. Every meeting they had provocateurs and people in the meetings. Now we find this out. But that's also true for all peaceful demonstration in the United States. Well, we know where the real left is. They're conscientious. But now it should show how mockingly disdainful the corporate left is when it comes to saying we're with you and they were part of the problem. Your thoughts?
You know, I've said this probably on your show back in 2008. Without going through all of that, in what you said that the private sector working with the government, with the police, the FBI, and other government agencies, it's called the merger of state and corporate powers. And people keep getting caught up in trying to redefine the definition by putting wrong terms into it. It's called fascism. The merger of state and corporate powers. What can anyone expect? It's as old as Mussolini and before. And it's happening here. It's called four words. Too big to fail. Washington is Wall Street. Wall Street is Washington. You talked about Alex Jones on Piers Morgan. And he started, going on about a new world order. And then, of course, everybody, what world new? You're conspiracy theorists. It's not a conspiracy. There is a new world order. It's called the banking order. And the banking order, it's not only in the United States. It's worldwide. Look what's going on in Europe. Look at how they're beating up the people. Look at the poverty. The new numbers just came out in Spain, Italy, and Greece. Between those three countries, the unemployment rate for young adults, for people under 35 years old, actually, is between 30% and 50%. They still call it a recession. In Greece, in Spain, the unemployment rates are 27% officially. And they call it a recession. So, Gary, this is what happens when societies break down. And these societies are being—they're broken down by the banks. And so, this is a fascist society. The behavior is indicative to the disease.
All right. Now, this to follow up on what you just said. This is from Matt Tabibi in Rolling Stone. And it's an article just today, and it says, Secrets and Lies of the Wall Street Bailout. The federal rescue of Wall Street did not fix the economy. It created a permanent bailout state based upon a Ponzi-like confidence scheme, and the worst may yet to come. Let me quote his first two paragraphs. It has been four long winters since the federal government, in the hulking, shaven, scald, alienation-esque form of then-Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson, committed $700 billion in taxpayer money to rescue Wall Street from its own chicanery and greed. To listen to the bankers and their allies in Washington tell it, you'd think the bailout was the best thing to hit the American economy since the invention of the assembly line. Not only did it prevent another Great Depression, we've been told, but the money has been paid back, all of it, and the government even made a profit. No harm, no fool, right? Wrong. It's all a lie. One of the biggest, most elaborate falsehoods ever sold to the American people. We were told that the taxpayer was stepping in only temporarily, mind you, to prop up the economy and save the world from financial catastrophe. What we actually ended up doing was the exact opposite. We're committing American taxpayer to permanent, blind support of an ungovernable, unregulatable, hyper-concentrated new financial system that exacerbates the greed and inequality that caused the crash and forces Wall Street banks like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup to increase risk rather than reduce it. The result is one of those deals where one wrong decision early on blossoms into a lush nightmare of unintended consequences. We thought we were just letting a few friend crash at the house for a few days. We ended up with a family of hillbillies who moved in forever, sleeping nine in a bed and building a meth lab in the front lawn. But the most appalling part is the lying. The public has been lied to shamelessly and so often in the course of the past 4 years that the failure to tell the truth to the general populace has become a kind of a baked-in official feature of the financial rescue. Money wasn't the only thing the government gave Wall Street. It also conferred the right to hide the truth from the rest of us. And it was all done in the name of helping regular people create jobs. It is, says former bailout Inspector General Neil Barofsky, the ultimate bait and switch. The bailout deceptions came early, late, and in between. There were lies told in the first moments of their inception and others still being told 4 years later. The lies, in fact, were the most important mechanisms of the bailout. The only reason investors haven't run screaming from an obviously corrupt financial marketplace is because the government has gone to such extraordinary lengths to sell the narrative that the problems of 2008 have been fixed. Investors may not actually believe the lie, but they are impressed by how totally committed the government has been from the very beginning to selling it. Today, what few remember about the bailouts is what we had to approve then. Anyhow, it's a long article, and it's a well-done article, and I commend Matt on it. Your thoughts about the fact that virtually all of the Wall Street firms were lying, they are all corrupt, they have engaged in nothing but corrupt illegal practices, with a full cooperation of both Republicans and Democrats, with Treasury secretaries, with the head of the Federal Reserve. It's one giant cesspool, and no one has the power to change it at this time. Your thoughts?
Well, there is. People have the power to change it. It's just not the people in power that are going to change it.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant.
The Bananos or Gambinos to go straight, and that's all the Republicans and the Democrats are. And why, again, you know, I just pulled up a piece that we did. This is September 15th, 2009. No cover up, no recovery. It's a cover up, not recovery. It's just a cover up. And you want to talk about scandals and how corrupt it all is? How about this one? LIBOR. No one's talking about the LIBOR rates. So, you know, the interest rates that everybody has to pay, that have been fixed by the major banks around the world. That's right, fixed. The game is totally rigged. And according to the emails, our now Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, he knew about it. Mervyn King over there in England, they knew about it back in 2008, 2009. It's a corrupt system from top to bottom. And you want to talk about nobody going to jail, nobody doing any time? You didn't see one head roll under the Obama administration. for, you know, when he went over to Wall Street, you know, the reckless behavior, you know, unchecked excess is at the heart of the crisis, he said. We can be confident that the storms of the past 2 years are beginning to break. He said that in September of 2009. And then again, I could take it personally. My money was stolen from me by John Corzine, the former senator and governor of New Jersey. John Corzine, the former head of the Goldman Sachs gang. That's right. Also the head of MF Global. They went into segregated accounts. I had my money in a segregated account. He went in and stole it because to satisfy his bad gambling habit. Do you see his head roll? He's not even being called up for questioning by the authorities. Oh, and by the way, you know who runs the Commodities Future Trading Commission? Yeah, Gary Gensler. Where did he come from? Didn't he work with Corzine at the Goldman Sachs gang? It's one big club. Who is the guy, Gary, that destroyed the Glass-Steagall Act that was put in place during the Great Depression?
Bill Clinton, there were four people. Bill Clinton authorized it because he's always been on the inside track of getting the hand out. You had Rubin, who was Secretary of the Treasury. You had Texas Republican, who was the biggest advocate within the Congress on this. And Larry Summers, who was an advisor on it.
All right. Now, where did Rubin come from, Gary?
Goldman Sachs. He was the president of Goldman Sachs.
That's right. Who's the head of the European Central Bank? Mario Draghi.
Former chairman of Goldman Sachs, president of Goldman Sachs, one of the top executives of Goldman Sachs.
Right,
vice chairman.
Of the European division.
Yes.
Three-card Monty over there in Italy, international advisor for Goldman Sachs. Who's the new head of the Bank of England?
Also from Goldman Sachs.
Mark Carney, that's right.
Yes.
I mean, what a surprise. I mean, why keep this game going?
That's a cartel, all right? That's a cabal.
It's the new world order.
That's correct.
It's the banking order.
I agree. All right, and one more thing here. By the way, I am going to take some calls. In our normal program is 55 minutes. At the end of that 55 minutes, we will extend this with Gerald, and you'll have a chance to share your points of view on TalkBack at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And for those of you who will not be able to listen to it because your station will be at the end of the 55-minute program, you can use the telephone at 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, anywhere in America. In Canada, you can use that and hear the program. And by the way, we just got a letter today, and you'll find this interesting, Gerald. So many people are using the phone to listen to the show now that we're number one in all of America of all the stations using it. And I think we just crossed the line of 3 million minutes there. So a lot of people are using this technology. Now, Gerald, next, let me also mention before I forget that this Sunday, noon, I'll be having a discussion, not a lecture, on homesteading. People actually want to be considered and interviewed for homesteading positions. You'll call 646-926-5422 for that. Gerald, next up, and this is about the former advisor, Obama as, quote, ruthless and indifferent to rule of law as Bush, from Beth Brogan, staff writer for Common Dreams. Quote, a former security advisor for Barack Obama now says the president's Pentagon's targeted drone program is counterproductive, is, quote, encouraging a new arms race, and has killed far more civilians than has been acknowledged. And this was in the current edition of International Affairs. Michael Doyle, a LaSalle University expert on counterterrorism who served as Obama's campaign counterterrorism expert, is now coming out and saying that he's just as ruthless and just as indifferent, quote, to the rule of law as his predecessor, and they're killing a lot more people than what they're being honest about. Your thoughts on these drones and our war on terror?
Well, again, you know, it's everybody knows it. Nobody wants to talk about it. You know, these are extrajudicial killings. When you read the language of these drone strikes. You know, 10 militants were killed. And they always live in compounds, by the way. You know, they never live in houses. They're always compounds. And it's against international law. And that's what I keep saying, Gary. It's a culture of cruelty. They're allowed to get away with it. And then with the United States, with its great hypocrisy, denounces other nations for the atrocities that they commit. So it's just going on like this. And it's becoming more violent. And here's what I'm concerned about. Just as no one is stopping this from happening, my greatest concern right now, and it's going to be, we're finishing up the top trends of this year with the magazines coming out, is war. And they're going to take us to war. And I'm afraid that the next war is going to be in Syria.
Okay, but hold your thoughts, because we're at the end of this program, and I want to say goodbye to our stations and thank everyone for listening. We're going to continue on with Gerald Celante over Progressive Radio Network or the phone number I gave you, 832-280-0066. Now, there's a major report. I was going to talk with you about this, about the truth behind our actions and behind the scenes in Syria. We've planned on this incursion, this civil war in Syria, because it suited our needs to have Syria taken out of the pictures, being a supporter of Iran and physically beside Iran, so that it would give a better position for the United States and Israel against Iran. Your thoughts?
Oh, well, exactly. I mean, we were writing about this, you know, for 2 years now, when the so-called Arab Spring first began to break out. It's exactly why. And also that Syria and Libya were the only bases where Russia and China had access into the Mediterranean. These only places they were going. And so with Syria out of the way, then Iran is next. And there's also another very important note into this. Matter of fact, if people go to my website, trendsjournal.com, and go to my media blog, there's an interview with me and the bureau chief from Al Jazeera, Washington bureau chief, prior to the United States humanitarian mission in Libya, so-called humanitarian mission. This guy goes off the charts when I call him out. Anyway, because this all ties together, because you're talking about why doesn't the media do this, why doesn't the media do that. As you well know, Al Gore just scored $100 million by selling his current TV cable station, of which nobody was watching, 42,000 viewers at a high spot each night on a show, given show. So who bought it? Al Jazeera. Who owns Al Jazeera? The Qatar government. Members of the Arab League. The same Qatar government that was funneling all of the arms along with Saudi Arabia into Libya with the acquiescence of the United States and destabilized that area. The same Qatar government that is behind the Syrian revolution, of which you keep seeing over and over again. It's the same kind of Islamic groups that are the radical fringe. And now they are going to have their voice in America. Isn't that nice? So when you put all these pieces together, it's a continuation of the United States trying to gain more and more control over the oil-rich, resource-rich Middle East.
One last thought on this from Chris Hedges, State of Fear, from TruthDig.com. Quote, Shannon Mecklish of Florida is a 45-year-old mother of two children. She is a homemaker, a taxpayer, and a safe driver. She votes in every election. She attends a Unitarian church on Sundays. She is also, like nearly all who have a relationship with the Occupy movement in the United States, being monitored by the federal government. She knows this because she's read FBI documents obtained by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund through the Freedom of Information Act. She was startled to see a redaction that could only be referring to her. Her story is the story of hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps more, whose lives are being invaded by this state. It is the story of a security and surveillance apparatus overseen by the executive branch under Barack Obama that has empowered the FBI and Department of Homeland Security to silence the voices and obstruct the activity of citizens who question corporate power. And so here we have, and it's a good article by Chris, and I recommend people read it, but we are living in a state of fear in the United States. For many people who have consciousness, they know that if they protest, if they go against corporate rule or the government, they will become on someone's watch list. And then on top of that, we have today, Congress is less popular than cockroaches and Genghis Khan. Quote, yeah, true. This is true. The little of U.S. Congress, fresh off its fiscal cliff budget, is now less popular than cockroaches and lice. The public policy polling surveyed 830 Americans and revealed that Congress has hit new lows in the eyes of the same U.S. voters who sent representatives to work. The legislative body proved less popular than traffic jams, Donald Trump, France, lice, Genghis Khan, cockroaches, and used car dealers, the poll found. So how is it that on the one hand we are a nation of fear, on the other hand we are a nation of bread and circuses to distract us from the pain and angst of a surrealistic existence? Your thoughts?
It's people won't let go of their belief systems. And they still, even though they say that, they believe in others. You know, politics in America is like a religion. And you know me, I'm a political atheist. I don't believe in political religions. And when you tell somebody that you don't, you know, agree with their political religion and they can't proselytize you, they get really tight and angry about it. So on one hand, the people are saying that, but on the other hand, they're afraid to let go of their belief system. And that's why they keep tolerating it, I believe. And the other one is, and I keep saying this over and over again, and it's talking to you and the people listening, it's preaching to the choir, because you understand that it's physical, emotional, and spiritual. It's all of those elements have to be put into place in the individual before things change. And until people change themselves and reach the highest level within them that they could attain and bring that special gift that they have to its maximum point of efficiency and effectiveness, then nothing changes. So right now it's become, as I said, you know, the culture is too complacent.
Just two thoughts. We're going to take a call here. Texas school can force teenagers to wear a locator chip. The judge says from Reuters, quote, San Antonio, a public school district in Texas, can require students to wear locator chips when they are on school property. Federal judge ruled. They're being fought on this by the American Civil Liberties Union. But years ago, we would never have thought that school kids would be forced to wear these radio frequency identifications or the RFID because we didn't consider the children should be monitored that way, and yet now that is the rule, and let's see how that goes. I want to finish up with you today, Gerald, by getting your look at three areas in real brief. One, what do you see happening for the average American, and that means the professional class, the working class, the underpaid working class, the poor in the United States over the next 12 months?
Work longer, work harder, and get less. And again, when you look at this so-called fiscal cliff drama, who was the one that paid? People paid. You know, we all have to pay more Social Security tax. So it's the game is rigged.
Do you see the value of our currency being affected, gold, silver, based upon any of the things that are happening in the world today?
Gold prices should be much higher than they are. I mentioned at the top of the show, every nation virtually is devaluing their currency by printing more of it. The more you print, the less it's worth. Gold prices should continue to go up. My economic forecast in a sentence, more of the same, but worse.
Okay. Let's say a quick hello to Harvey from Berkeley, California. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Gary, and hello, Gerald. You're absolutely right. It is a cruel society. I'd like to talk about the war on drugs that people seldom mention. I believe the war on drugs is the new slavery. The most affected are American youth of African descent. And it turns out that corporations like CCA, Corrections Corporations of America, one of their executives once said that they need... if there was any change in the war on drugs, they'd lose their workforce. They need a nonviolent workforce.
Well, they have it. Harvey, we're out of time, but I did discuss the war on drugs for about 15 minutes at the beginning of the program. Maybe you didn't hear that. I want to close today, Gerald, with an open letter. This is an open suicide letter to Monsanto. This is a note which one farmer left, unseen and unread, blowing along the rows of his once fertile, now ruined land. I'll quote it. This is from elephantjournal.com. It rains. Rain surrounds me. This once would have caused me great joy. Today, my thirst is unslacked. Impotence, rage, and red-faced fury. Today, all are burned into resignation. Holding a jug of your killing Roundup, I drink. The relief I feel with the flow of poison is my freedom. Stepping off the planet, I will discover a land of real meadows, unengineered animals, alive, unpolluted waters. I will meet undead weeds with new and quiet reverence. There is no way to win at this game. Your company and your corporate parents have rigged it. At the expense of me and my land, you gained a tiny crumb. My children and my home, microscopic food, my brother's farmer, all of us together almost make up a portion of a bite at your vast, untroubled corporate table. Tagore spoke of the life force which shoots in joy through the dust of the earth in numerous blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. What might he have said about the poisons and chemicals now showered over our fields, the layer of death and sorrow coating what was once our meadows? Life is owned by death. I return myself today to my owner, partially used, wholly spent. Outcry at thousands and thousands of my brother's suicides was stilled. You bought deafness. The cold, steel, totalitarian corporate hand clenches around me. My heart is heavier than an ox. I know, I see, there is no fighting this. This is too big for me. You are impervious. My prayers are for you, for your hands, for your voice, for your heart. For my part, drinking this poison, choosing death, I let this bowing to death and this mass enslavement end. Let the life force that shoots through the dust of the earth into my body and soul beget life through my deed. 260,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide because of genetic engineering, and not a single comment can be found to grieve them, to see significance in their death. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening.
Eutrice, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
We'll start soon.
PRN.